This week's Parsha Chayesar, we have the first, not the first marriage, of course, Parsha is Bereishis, but the first courtship, and therefore I wanted to take the opportunity to discuss a topic that has received attention over the last 25 years, but even more so over the last number of years in the larger world of Psak Halacha, and that is the topic of prenuptial agreements, not the prenuptial agreements that are financially oriented in terms of preserving, which you might find in a second marriage, which are focused on preserving assets and maintaining it within, one's biological family, but the kind of prenuptial agreements that are designed in order to prevent a tragic situation, which unfortunately arises every now and then, of a woman who's left in aguna because her husband won't deliver a get. So the prenuptial agreements are designed in order to prevent that situation from arising, but in order to understand how they're designed and what is the discussion that centers around it, we first really need to understand what the issue is in the first place. So the Mishnah tells us in Masechtas Gittin on Peches Mebeis that a get me'usa be Yisrael kedin is kosher. If you have a get that's compelled by Yisraelim through a Beis Din that's licensed to do so, then it's kosher. Shaloi kedin, if it's done either by a Beis Din that's not licensed to do so or under illegitimate circumstances, then it is pasul. Why can you not compel a husband to give a get under all circumstances? So the Rambam explains in Perek Aleph of Chazgerishin, Halacha Aleph and Beis, that it's because the get is supposed to be given willingly by the husband. This is based on the pasuk in Parashas Kisetzav, Ha'yom lo yisim tzachem be'enav, because of a sefer krisis v'nosim b'yada v'shilcha b'beisoy, that if it will be that she will not find favor in his eyes, he'll write for her a bill of divorce, he'll place it in her hand, and then he'll send it from the house. So from the fact that the pasuk describes this scenario as v'hayom lo yisim tzachem be'enav, it will be that she won't find favor in his eyes, that implies that this is something that's subjective, it's up to him to determine, and therefore we derive from here, says the Rambam, l'amei she'enu megarish b'r tzaynai, v'nishgarish v'shalo b'r tzaynai, enu megureshes. It has to be a mosif tzachem b'yenev, it has to be something that he wants to do, and if it's something that's forced upon him, then the get would be would not be kosher. There are certain circumstances, though, when a get, so therefore a get that's compelled either by a body that's not licensed to do so, like a secular court, is never licensed to do so, or even an individual is not licensed to, right, to force people to fulfill the mitzvos. Even though we can compel people to eat matzah, we can compel people to to stop wearing shatnez. Every individual isn't necessarily licensed to do so, but a qualified Beis Din has the ability to do that. It's one of the unique duties of the Beis Din and responsibilities of the Beis Din to be kofen al mitzvos. In the times when that's acceptable. So but if it's either done by a body that's not licensed to do so, or under circumstances where it's not warranted, then the get is no good. The get has to be given Mirat Sinai. But there are certain circumstances outlined by the Mishnah in Ksubis, and Marmaseth and Zivamas, which are beyond the scope of our discussion, where a get can be compelled because the husband is obligated to give a get. What are circumstances like this? They're married by Iser, right? Nisu and Shaloi Kedas Moshe of Yisrael. They kind marries a Gusha, or a person marries one of the Arayos. A person you're not allowed to remain married to, so then one is obligated to divorce his wife, and Chazal would have the, a Bezim would have the ability to compel him to do so. Kaifen Asala Haitzi. But short of that, those extremes, there are certain other situations that are discussed by the Mishnayos and the Gemara and the Paiskim, but many of them are debates, abusive relationships or things surrounding those kinds of, relationships. All of them, every case, of course, is different, but there are parameters and, that are outlined by the Paiskim. Certain circumstances, it might be advisable to give a get. Other circumstances in extreme cases, even Kaifan Oysel Ohaitzi, might even compel him to give a get. If he's obligated to give a get, we can compel him to give a get. But if he's really not obligated to give a get, let's say the relationship is not working, everyone's on different pages and different agendas in life, and they don't get along anymore. So it might be advisable to divorce because she doesn't want to remain in the relationship, but it's not obligated to divorce her in that situation, and therefore we can't be kofen osel haitzi. If we do so, the get would be a compelled get. It's not mirat Sinai, and the get would be no good. It's a get ma'usa. If he's obligated to divorce her, so then we can't compel him. But if you compel him in a case when he's not obligated to do so, so Tosis writes over here, Masech Tzuba, so he's Gimel, in the name of Rabbeinu Chananel, Shein kofen oheicha shemefarish behedya kofen. We can only kofen him where it says in the Gemara that he's obligated to give a get. Then we can compel him to do it. Oheicha the Amar Rabbanon Yoytzi. If Chazal just said it's a good idea, you should get divorced, we can tell him you're obligated to divorce him, but we can't compel him to do it unless it's an absolute obligation. If it's an absolute obligation, then we can compel him to give a get. The obvious question, though, is if the get has to be given mirtzayno, it has to be given willingly, how can we ever compel him to give a get? The get is not being done, is being only carried out under duress. How is that considered to be willingly? So the Gemara, the explanation is based on the Gemara Masechet Baba Basra, Mem Zayin Mem Beis, going over to Mem Ches Mem Aleph, about Tal Yuhu V'Zavin Zvini Zvini. Says the Gemara, if I compel somebody to sell a piece of real estate to me, so then the Gemara says the sale is valid, because in the end of the day, he consented to the sale. Why did he consent to the sale? Because of all the pressure that I brought to bear on him, social pressure or maybe even physical duress. But I coerced him to sell the building, I extorted him to sell the building, the sale is still valid, because in the end of the day, he consented to the sale. Or the Gemara says that if Tayu of a Kaddish, Kiddush of Kiddush, we force a husband, right? This is an aggressive approach to the Shidduch problem. We could, speaking obviously, just kidding, right? That we could compel the husband to marry the wife. If we compel the wife to marry the husband, the Gemara says, who also shalai kidin? I know us and emo shalai kidin, and we'll undo the marriage, because Chazal have the ability to undo all marriages of kinu rabbanu and kiddusha mine, because everybody who gets married, having in mind the standards of the Chachamim and the Kedash Moshe of Yisrael, if he gets mine, if he does something shalai kidin, we have the ability under rare circumstances to say avkinu rabbanu and kiddusha mine. So if he compels the wife to marry him, then the Gemara says, we undo the marriage. But if let's say they compel the husband to marry her, Tell you Kaddish, the Gemara says Kiddush of Kiddush, because at the end of the day you consented to the marriage, you consented to sell the property. The Gemara says everybody only ever sells a piece of property under duress. Why else would you sell property? I remember we were once in a meeting about the financial status of yeshiva, and someone announced, we just sold properties and now we have extra cash. I'm like, no, that's bad. You only sell properties if you're under duress. Why else would you liquidate properties, right? So everybody sells something, does so under duress. So yeah, you're right, it's not because of physical, a threat. But at the same time, since it's always under duress, if a sale is conducted under duress, that's considered to be a valid sale. Kiddush of Kiddushin as well. So too says the Gemara, in this context, in the second line, that if a man is forced to is compelled to give a get, Kaifin I say, Shiyama writes, honey, we wait until he says, I consent to give the get, and the get is valid. Just like the sale, just like the kiddushin, we compel him to give the get. He wants to do it in the end. You consented to do it, so it's valid. However, here there's an additional requirement where the husband must say, "Roitzani, I want to do it. I want to do it." But he doesn't want to do it. He's being compelled to do it. So the Rambam explains in Perek Beis of Hilchos Gerushin Halacha Chaf, perhaps arguably one of the most famous passages in all of the Mishnah Torah, where the Rambam says, "Yeah, he says, ostensibly, externally, he doesn't want to do it, but his inner self." His real self, the one that's tied to the Ribbono Shel Olam, wants to fulfill the mitzvahs of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though he's saying he doesn't, he really does. Because inside, every Jew wants to fulfill the mitzvahs of Hashem. So we force him. When he says, right, Tani, he doesn't. He just 2 minutes ago said, I'm never doing this. But because we're compelling him forcibly to do it, so he says, right, Tani. He only says, right, Tani, because of all the force that we're bringing to bear. But at the same time, inside, he really wants to fulfill the mitzvahs of Hashem. But that only applies if there is a mitzvah to do so. If he's not obligated to, under that circumstance, because of a mitzvah, divorce his wife, then that is not. We can't interpret his right, Tani, to mean that I really, really want to fulfill the mitzvahs of Hashem, because there is no mitzvah of Hashem necessarily to divorce your wife under this circumstance. So you can only be kaifeh, you can only compel him to give a get when he is obligated to do so, because then you really, really want to give it. If he's not obligated to do so, then you can't. That's a get ma'usa. A get has to be given, mirat Sinai, and here we have no right to be kaifeh him. They'll be considered to be a get under duress. But what's interesting is by getting, you have to say right, Sani. The husband has to say, I want to do it in the end. When it comes to tell you of his oven, zvini, zvini, or when it comes to tell you of a kaddish, kiddush of kiddushin, we force him to get married, we force him to sell a property. So the Rambam never mentions that the husband has to say, or the seller has to say right, Sani. We compel him to do it. He signs the paper. He doesn't have to verbalize rights on me. How come by the Gerush and all of a sudden he does? So the Ravid actually calls out the Rambam. He says, you're being inconsistent. If you have to say rights on me by the Gerush, and in the end you have to consent verbally, so you should have to consent verbally when it comes to the sale of a property, when it comes to Kiddusha, when it comes to making Kiddushin as well. Why does the Rambam distinguish between the two? So the Nesivus explains as well, Vitzel Lopanovich and Yosef Ezechiel Yitzchak, they quote like this in the name of Reb Chaim also, that it's because Gerushin requires a higher level of consent. See, when it comes to selling a property, when it comes to making Kiddushin, we don't have a Xeris HaKosav that tells me you have to do so willingly. Of course, if someone takes my stuff, that's called Geneva. Of course, it's only called a sale because I consented. If I didn't consent, that's not called a sale, that's called Geneva. right? Every transaction implicitly requires consent. Why do I need a Xeris HaKosuv by Gerish and it has to be Miritsono? It has to be with his consent. Every transaction has to be with consent. No, it's because the Rambam feels when it comes to Gerishin, it's not enough that you have consent. You have to do so meirotzon. You have to do so willingly. Willingly, because I want to do it, is a higher level of consent than just I agree. Right? I agree. Okay, agreed. I'll sell you a property. I don't want to do it, but I'll sell you the property. When it comes to Gerishin, it has to be something you want to do. That's what the Xeris HaKosuv is coming to teach me. So by Gerishin, it's not enough that I consent. Okay, we'll sell. Fine. No, it has to, but do you want to? No, but it has to be something you want to do. So therefore, when it comes to Gerishin, it's a higher level of consent, a higher level of das, and therefore it has to, it requires even that the husband formally say, Roitzani. Okay, so there are certain circumstances when a get can be compelled. Those circumstances are few and far between. Most divorces don't rise to that situation. And of course, in Eretz Yisrael, they do have the ability to be kaifin. They'll put their husband in jail if he refuses to give his wife a get when it can be forced under those unique circumstances. Of course, in Chutz Laaretz, it goes without saying that would be illegal, and we have no such ability to do so. So that's even in case we never pass in Chutz Laaretz kaifin, because we have no mechanism with which to do it, aside from the fact that the cases are often controversial, halachically, and few and far between to begin with, so it's not really a practical solution. Yeah.
And then we deal with this Rambam when it comes to, in the Gunnar crisis, and then there's people who, beat him up.
Oh, okay.
It's not required, so...
You can only do the physical anything if there's... If he's obligated to give a get, which first has to be determined by Beis Din, has to be kaifa, and even in America, it's illegal. So these things are never condoned, and would be.
It does go on, though, no?
Should be discouraged. I have no knowledge of that. I've heard about such things, but I can't speak. I have no intimate knowledge of any of that. But there is something short of kaifa, which is social pressure. So the Ramah over here, Simi Kufnu Dal Sifchof Aleph, quotes from the Sefer Yosef Rabbeinu Tam, was known as Harchokis the Rabbeinu Tam. You're right, we can't be kofa a person to give a get unless it's, first of all, it's halachically, licensed body that's able to do it, which would be, a legitimate Beis Din. And they've determined that this is one of those rare situations when the husband is actually obligated to give a get, not just advisable, not just recommended, he's obligated to give a get. So then they could be kofa. But even, short of that, even in those situations which are not that, you have Harchokas the Rabbeinu Tam, we don't have to do business with him. I don't have to welcome him into the shul. I don't have to, we can distance ourselves from him because that's indirect. We're not compelling, I'm not, going and, forcibly, directly compelling him to give the get. We're indirectly making his life not comfortable within the community because we're frowning upon the way he's conducting himself. Frowning, obviously, being an understatement, right? So we're not happy with the way that he's conducting himself. We cannot, go after him directly, but because we have no license to do so. But at the same time, we don't have to necessarily treat him, as an upstanding member of the community. You cannot put him in nidui, says the Rabbeinu Tam already, that's considered to be a forcible coercion, even though it's not a physical coercion, it is a spiritual coercion. A cherem is oisiois ramach, because it's a curse that enters into all of his ramach evarim. We hope he gets cursed, right? It's a curse of death. It's a terrible thing, a cherem, and nidui, very, very heavy consequences. So that's considered to be a direct assault spiritually, and therefore that would be, we wouldn't be licensed to do that unless it's a case of kaifin. But we can distance ourselves from him. So the Shach, already quoted by the Piskei Teshuva, there's a Kohen Lamed and the Sefer Gvuras Hanoshim, who questions this. So there could be so much communal pressure that's brought to bear that it's the equivalent of Nidoy and Cherem, right? If you picture the small town where, the Shach or any of the, few hundred years ago, people weren't as mobile as they are today. If no one's doing business with you in your town and no one's marrying you, you're up the creek. I mean, so that's the equivalent of nidui, even though without the teeth, there's no cherem here, but it's the equivalent of it. You're being excommunicated. So in today's society, so he felt that was too much, Harchokas Rabbeinu Tam. Others disagreed with the Shach, even in his time, and certainly in our time, where people have the ability to move around, people are distancing themselves from you. Yeah, what usually happens, though, is that the Harchokas Rabbeinu Tam follow the Ma'agin wherever he goes. And, obviously once it's posted online, and, who knows what will happen. But at the same time, it's not, you can find some pocket of the Jewish community, they'll probably, Chabad somewhere, find your way. So it's not really the same as a Nidui or a Cherem, it's a Chokas or a Rabbeinu Tam, and that was considered to be permissible. But again, as we know from our experience, sometimes it has, you know, varying degrees of being effective. It's not a fail-safe to the Aguna situation. So in 1983, because of this ongoing situation, it's going on a long time, so there was a lobby in the New York State to pass what was known as the first Get Law. The Get Law states, which was passed in 1983 in New York State, that a civil divorce cannot be issued where there was a petition for a religious divorce, and the religious divorce has not been granted. So if, you know, obviously goyim don't need a religious divorce in order to get a civil divorce, but if a Jew petitions for a religious divorce, and the religious divorce has not been granted, then the judge presiding over the case will not issue a civil divorce either. And that was passed. Now that is why aren't we forcing him? We're holding the civil divorce up as we're extorting him in order to give a get. Isn't that compelling him to do it? That's not a indirect. That's direct. So the answer obviously is no. That is indirect. Why is it indirect? Because you're not entitled to a civil divorce. That is something the state grants you. So that's like it's a privilege. It's not a right. So therefore, no one is punishing you. We're just not granting you a civil divorce unless until such time the person will provide his wife with a religious divorce. That's not considered to be directly compelling. It's not a get me'usa. That was Ramosha Paskins already asked in 1983 about this, and Ramosha felt that was not a get me'usa, and therefore that was accepted. The problem is, as everything is, that there's a loophole. What's the loophole? The husband could say, gamli gamloch lo yiyeh, I'm fine, let's remain married. No civil divorce. So now she gets no religious divorce. So everyone's stuck, understood, but she's stuck, which is highly unfortunate, and she's this is being forced upon her. So that's so they lobbied for a second get law, which they hoped would close this, satisfy this problem, which was called the 1993 get law, the second get law, which stipulated that not only can the civil divorce be held up if the religious divorce is not granted, but that the judge can take that into consideration when dividing their assets. So, in terms of the financial distribution of the marriage. So the husband can, in effect, be penalized financially for not granting his wife a religious divorce. The problem with that is, so that can be viewed in one of two ways, as it was interpreted by judges in New York State. When they discussed the law with them, how did they interpret it? So some judges interpreted this as, well, the marriage is dissolving, even though there's no civil divorce and there's no religious divorce, but they're not living together anymore. He has to provide her with support. Mezainus, which we would call in the Gemara. So it has to, he has to provide her with support. So when dissolving their assets or splitting apart the assets, we have the right to provide her with something that will constitute support. Mezainus. So no one's being forced to give a get. We're just, she needs to be provided for. If that would be the case, then Ramayisha writes in the Tshuva, then the get would be valid. That's not a get Mu'usa. She has every right. She's entitled to Mizana. Says Ramayisha. He wasn't talking about the get law. In 1993, Ramayisha was not no longer alive. So he wasn't commenting on the get law in 1993. He was commenting on something that was occurring in South Africa. There's Uvidavah Hashayla. If the secular court will award her money for support, until he'll provide her with a religious divorce, is this considered to be a get me'usa? He says no. Husband is obligated to support his wife, as we say in the Ksuba. He's going to provide for her. So since he's obligated to provide for her, and the state is compelling him to provide for her, no one's compelling him to give a get, but compelling him to provide for her, even though Ramayisha says, it's a little bit above and beyond maybe what it says in the Ksuba, Ramayisha felt that was not considered to be a get me'usa, and therefore... generally speaking, that could be allowed. The problem, though, is with the get law, is that some judges interpret it not as just providing her with support, which would be a minimal award, right? It might even be punitive. We're penalizing the husband for not granting her a religious divorce, and therefore attempting to compel him by giving him these punitive damages to ultimately grant her a religious divorce. That's a direct financial assault on his estate, which we're trying to compel him to give a divorce. That already borders on now a get me'usa. So Shlomo Zalman and Rabbi Yashiv were active in 1993, so they felt that they were asked about this issue, and the different judges interpreted it different ways. Some judges felt it was just to provide support. Some judges interpreted it as a penalty, and since it could easily be interpreted as a penalty to the husband for not providing and giving his wife a religious divorce, therefore many assumed that the 1993 get law, if evoked, would produce only a get ma'usa. So that those solutions are not really going to help us, even though the get laws were well-intentioned, they're not going to help us, unless the get law would be modified. I'm not going to help us to resolve this situation. But what perhaps could be a little bit closer to a potential remedy is, what if the husband will accept upon himself a self-imposed penalty if he will not deliver a get in a timely fashion? It wasn't imposed on him by another body. It was self-imposed. So Beis Yosef in Siman Kuf Lamed Aleph Sif Dal, Ibn Ezer, quotes from Rav Maimon Na'or, that if it's a self-imposed penalty, that's forcing himself to give a get, since it's self-imposed, how could that be a get ma'usa? It's based on his own admission, his own design. And the Rashba, Chelek Daled Siman Mem, seems to disagree that even if it's a knas atzmo, it's something that's self-imposed, that would still be considered a get ma'usa, because in the end of the day, he's being compelled to give the get, something which he ostensibly is not pleased about doing. So the Ramah, Paskins, like the first opinion in the Beis Yosef, not like the Rashba, that a get that's given based on a self-imposed fine, a self-imposed penalty, even though it's acknowledged as a penalty, right? A guy says, and this is the way that initially a prenup was designed in the early 80s. They suggested a prenup that a husband will sign before he gets married, that if, the time will come when one of the parties will ask for a divorce, and the husband will not provide his wife for the divorce, he will accept upon himself a penalty of $250 a day, to pay. So, and obviously that's encouraging him to give the get, but it's a self-imposed penalty, and of course he could continue to pay the penalty. He doesn't have to give the get, so it's not really forcing him in any real sense, right? So, so that was based on this Ramah, and the Ramah says, even though, he says, v'yesh machmirin, there are those who are machmir, he quotes on the second line, that's the Rashba, he says it's a good thing to be, to be choishish for the opinion of the Rashba, but you knew you have a tragedy of a guna situation on your hands, so maybe it would be better not to be choishish for the opinion of the Rashba. Here it says, but you have a tragedy over here of a guna situation, so maybe it's not toiv lochus shulchachilah and when the stakes are that high. And therefore, they designed a prenuptial agreement that would install a self-imposed penalty upon the husband if he won't deliver a get in a timely fashion. And it's something he accepted upon himself based on the opinion of the Ramah. However, if you're trying to gain traction within the larger Jewish community, this is not the way to do it, right? V'toiv lochus l'chachila, the Ramah says, really, this is not accepted l'chachila. No one wants to have people signing documents that's, the normative practice when it's not in accordance with halacha l'chachila. We don't really want that. And more than that, the Pesach Tshuva here quotes from the Tshuva's Mishkan Yitzyakov, who says, why did the Ramah ignore the Rashba? Why is it only tov lachos l'chachilo? The Rashba disagreed that the get is no good. It's a get ma'usa if it's a knas nasmo, even though it's a self-imposed penalty. So therefore, the Mishkan Yitzyakov felt that the get would be no good. There were different paiskim who sided on different sides of the issue. The Chazon Ish sided with the Ramah. The Aruch HaShulchan also doesn't believe that we should ignore the Rashba. We should consider the Rashba, and therefore, that kind of self-imposed penalty, a prenup with a self-imposed penalty, if he won't deliver again in a timely fashion, is not really the ideal situation. What one can do, and this is what the early prenup, already in the times of Rabbi Moshe, Rabbi Yechiel Per, who's a Rosh Hashiva in Far Rockaway, Rockaway sent a tshuva to Rav Moshe asking him, what about putting in the shtar tanoim, which is signed before the ksuba, which just basically says that everyone agrees to go through the marriage? It really doesn't have that much meaning anymore, because we're sitting at the chasen tish when you sign the shtar tanoim, everyone agrees to go through with the marriage. I haven't been yet at the wedding when that broke up between the chasen tish and the chuppah. Within the week I have been involved, like that, and that's really extreme. But we kind of neutered the Shtar Tanoim in our times, because the Shtar Tanoim used to be signed, and says some communities still do like this. They sign a year in advance and everyone agrees to do it, and it says a cheirim if you don't follow through. It's almost better, the Paiskim said, to just go through with the wedding and divorce rather than break the Shtar Tanoim because of all the consequences that were in the Shtar Tanoim. So Rav Moshe saw this, and Rav Moshe said, this is not going to end well. So Rav Moshe already we all use the Nusach of Rav Moshe in the Shtar Tanoim, which takes a lot of the consequences out of it. But now it's just like, it doesn't really accomplish much.
A break and play.
Yeah, it's like it's a photo opportunity, right? It accomplishes something. It demonstrates the fact that this was not a slingshot wedding that we arranged in Las Vegas. You know, this was something that was thought about, and this was something that was arranged, because the Gemara says, Rav mangid amanda mekadesh below shiduchi. Rav used to give malchus to a person who got married, you know, the drunken sailor marriages, you know, during Fleet Week, and then they come and get married. So, you know, that's we don't want those kinds of things. So it has to be arranged, and there was a tshtar tanoim, so it satisfies that the of Rav, that it should be arranged and prepared for, but we probably satisfied that by signing a contract with the caterer and with the hall, which demonstrating this is prepared 4 months in advance. I don't know, the Shtatron doesn't necessarily accomplish as much as it used to. But either way, Rebbe asked Rav Moshe, maybe we can install in the Shtatron a clause that if the parties will get into a dispute, you know, the husband and the wife, and they will no longer want to remain married, they agree to binding arbitration to go before a certain Beis Din. That way, it solves half the problem, because instead of figuring out how we're going to figure this out, we all agree to sit before this Beis Din, and they'll resolve the issue. So that, Rav Moshe actually writes, he felt was an important takana. Yeah, flip the page over here. Chelek Dalet, Siman Kuf Zayin, this is a tshuva to Rebbe Pair. This is the entire tshuva. It's four lines. He says, "Emnachon lahoisev b'shtar tonoim loshen kazem achrei nisun yavo idei pirut chas v'shalom." If chas v'shalom, the relationship will not work out, then the husband will not refrain from giving a get, because we're all going to go before Beis Din Ploni. And binding arbitration, which means if the husband will attempt to seek relief in secular court, the secular court will send you back to the Beis Din, because you signed a binding arbitration agreement in the Beis Din. That's what binding arbitration means. You agree not to go with the secular court, but to do binding arbitration. And then the court will enforce the ruling of the arbitration board of the Beis Din. The limitation of this, it helps, obviously, because you're going before a Beis Din, which can hopefully resolve the dispute. But the problem is that a Beis Din itself is not empowered to coerce a husband to give a get, right? Even a Beis Din can only be kaifa under rare circumstances. So under those rare circumstances, this might help. It won't really help under all circumstances. So this is helpful. It's to bind this one clause in the almost all prenuptial agreements is a binding arbitration clause, which is at least this from Rav Moshe, that we agreed to appear before arbitration before an agreed upon Beis Din. However, what was viewed as more successful was already a paradigm that was developed by the Torah's Gittin. Look back, it's Yud and Pesach Shuvah Sukkot and Test. The Torah's Gittin is in Hesivus' commentary on Evan Ezer. So he says, what about a situation where the husband will accept not a self-imposed penalty, which was controversial, right? Because in the end of the day, he's being penalized to give the get. It's coerced, even though it's self-imposed. He suggested, what if the husband will say, I agree to support you, even though, and to fulfill all my obligations in the marriage, not before the wedding. If they're running into problems and the wife is nervous that she's not going to get her get, he'll say, I'll continue to support you, even if you are not fulfilling your obligations of the marriage, of Aina, of Maisi Adayim, you're going to keep your wages and everything. I will pay you, continue to pay you your support, nonetheless. I'll fulfill my obligations of support, even though you're not contributing everything to the marriage. Right? The marriage is a system of obligations and benefits. Every person has part of the marriage has certain obligations and certain benefits that they enjoy. So he's saying, I'm willing to continue to provide you with the benefits, even though you're not contributing and fulfilling your obligations. And that will encourage him to give the gift. So Raisa Torah is getting near the Ba'ivan Zeyochoyim Lasas Kinyanim Behefsher. He'll be Michael all of her obligations to him. And then he'll remain with his obligations. And of course, over time, if she's not contributing anything to the relationship, that will encourage him to give again. The mile of this, says the Torah's Gittin, is it's not a penalty. This is he's leaving intact his regular obligation of support, which is outlined in the Ksuba on Eflok Va'okev Ezun Yafana Sikh Lichi. That's part of the obligation of the husband to the marriage. So he's saying, I'll leave that intact even though you're not contributing anything. And that will serve as a motivation for him to give the get. And the Torah's Gittin presumed that that was valid because, number one, it's not a penalty, and number two, it's not linked to the deliverance of a get. He's saying, I'm going to continue on with this indefinitely. If I'll choose to give a get, that will, of course, resolve the matter. So that's the paradigm of the Torah's Gittin. Is he leaving intact the Maisei Yadayim? And there's a similar suggestion found in Nachos Shiva. Nachos Shiva is a sefer on Evan Ezer, but just has a lot of boilerplates for shtaris. It's a lot of discussion about different shtaris in the Ksuba and the Tanoim and the Gittin. But it has a lot of, I'm sure lawyers have such a thing, which it just has boilerplates for a lot of different transactions. And then you modify it based on your given circumstances. So the Nachos Shiva also has, but he has a Shtar Tanoim from the cities of Shum. Anybody know what Shum is? Not garlic. Shum. Shum is the three cities in Germany of Worms, Magenta, Spira, which is a Spira, Worms, Magenta, which is Shum. Shin Bav Men, Rosh Tevis. And there were many takonas that were made in these very three powerful cities called Takana Shum. So in this Shtar Tanoim of Takana Shum, one of the stipulations was that if a fight will break out, then the husband agrees to provide her with an allowance while the dispute is taking place until such time that they come to a basin to resolve their dispute, and then hopefully they'll get back together and this will resolve the marriage. So he says, Vim Chas Vashom, she yasa kamar ploni anagos, who gossam maris ploni, says, Vim Shinicho, Lisbo, if she will be things she's upset about, the trichel, the basin, they need someone to mediate the situation. As Tekha Vumiyad, eating law asar zahuvim, will appease the mezainas, he'll give her asar zahuvim in lieu of her mezainas, Vichain eating law kochadish, Vichadish, Meshach mea katat. As long as the dispute is going on, he'll continue to provide her with mezainas. But so what these vehicles are doing is continuing on with the regular chiyuv of mizonos, which is part of the obligation of the marriage, but unilaterally, even though she's not necessarily providing or satisfying her obligations in the marriage, he continues to fulfill his regular obligation of mizonos. And then it's not considered to be a gemusa because he's just fulfilling the obligations he accepted at the very beginning. So based on this model, in 1988, there was a suggestion published in the journal called Moria, which was a tshuva that was sent from one person to another person by Rabbi Landisman to Rabbi Gartner, who then presented it to Rabbi Zalman Nechemia, discussed it with Rabbi Yashiv, of creating a prenuptial agreement where the husband will agree at the outset that if the wife will demand a divorce and he will not, he'll be recalcitrant, he will not be providing her with a divorce in a timely fashion, once she petitions for the divorce, that he will provide her with mezainos, with support nonetheless, until such time that he provides her with a get. So that it sounds like the Torah is getting. It's a little different. Why? And it might or might not be important. It's a little different because what we're doing here is artificially creating a secondary chiyuv mezainos. See, this is not saying the original chiyuv mezainos that is part of the marriage will continue even though she's not providing, you know, satisfying her obligations. There might be certain circumstances that will arise that a woman forfeits her chiyuv mezainos, her support. If she's the one who caused the marriage to break up, if she's a moredis, if she's not living up to the expectations of the marriage, she forfeits the ksuba. What forfeiting the ksuba means is she forfeits her rights and benefits in the marriage of the chiyuv mezainos. So there might be certain circumstances when she forfeits her chiyuv mezainos. So we could have said, no, it doesn't mean we're creating an artificial chiyuv mezainos that includes everyone. All we mean to say is the original chiyuv mezainos will continue on indefinitely, like the Torah's getting said. Even if he won't give a divorce, the chiyuv mezainos will continue on. The problem is that won't really solve all of the issues. Why not? Because he'll say, it's not my fault, this is your fault, and you're not entitled to mezainos. And she'll say, no, it's your fault, I am entitled to mezainos. How are we going to resolve it? Let's go to Beis Din. Yes, Kayach. Now we're back to the very same issue. How are we going to get everybody to go to Beis Din? If we get everybody to go to Beis Din, we wouldn't need these mechanisms. The problem is, the dispute is going to develop. Who is obligated? Who's the one who's causing the divorce to break up? Who did she or did she not forfeit a chiyuv mezainos? And guess who the burden of proof resides with? It resides with the wife because she has taken the money from the husband. So you want me to pay you mezainos? You have to demonstrate that it was my fault that the marriage broke up or that you're not a moredes and you're entitled to mezainos, which doesn't resolve the issue. So we want to make it carte blanche, no matter what the circumstances were. You know, unconditionally, the husband is going to provide her with mezainos after, you know, if she'll petition for a get and he won't provide her with one. The problem is, that's a new and artificial creation of a chiyuv mezainos, which, you know, switches the burden of proof instead of from the wife to the husband. That's wonderful, but that's something that's only taking place after, you know, they're no longer living together and in order to produce the get. Is such a mechanism valid? So already, this shaila was sent around to the Paiskim, and we'll get back to the Maria article, in the original article about it in a moment. But that was, this model was initially accepted, though, Rabbi Zalman Nechemia, Rabbi Avadia, Rabbi Willig drafted this in 1993, 1994, somewhere around there, to be, you know, as a prenuptial agreement for the Basin of America, which was endorsed. He brought it to many different Gedolim, and Rabbi Avadia and Rav Zalman Nechemia signed off on it, and they approved it. Even though it was an artificial chiyuv mezonos, in the end of the day, it's not structured as a knas, it's not structured as a penalty, it's structured as continuing on of the original chiyuv mezonos, even though it's really not, right? It's not the same chiyuv mezonos, it's a new one. The original one she might have forfeited, we don't know, and the burden of proof would be on her to demonstrate that she hasn't. But this is a new Chiyum Mezaynus, which will begin, but it's not structured as a Knas, and there's no mention of the fact that it's there to produce a get. So, ostensibly, it's no different than what the Torah's Gittin said. The Torah's Gittin said, let the old Chiyum Mezaynus continue. We don't want to do that because he'll dispute the fact and say, I don't owe you any Mezaynus. So what we're saying is, no, you have to give it unconditionally. That's a new obligation, yes, but it's structured as a Chiyum Mezaynus, and it's not necessarily designed to bring about, you know, it doesn't state anywhere that it's there to design to bring about a get, so therefore, those Paiskim accepted it. And Rav Asher Weiss, who was, I think, the first one to really pen a tshuva about it, so when Rav Asher Weiss was presented with the Shiloh by Rabbi Willig and by Rabbi Gartner, he also consented to this and described exactly that this follows the model of the Torah's Gittin. Why? Even though it's not exactly the same, because it's a chiyuv mizaynus, not a penalty, and it's not there. It's not. There's no mention of the fact that it's there to produce a get, so it's not a get ma'usa. However, one could have distinguished between that case and the Torah's Gittin's case. Why? And Rav Sternbach, in recent years, distinguished, as well as Rabbi Bleich, years ago. Rabbi Bleich already was involved in this, was one of the great places in the yeshiva, was involved in this already in the 80s also. And he was aware of this suggestion, and he argues as well, since the same point that Rabbi Sternbach, somewhat different formulation, but basically the same notion. Rabbi Sternbach said in recent years, and that was why other people opposed the Pino Bosa. Their argument was, there's a Beis Din of America made up of what is standard support, so they, you know, agreed $150 a day, all right, which amounts to about $54,000, $55,000 a year, which is, you know, I guess a moderate, standard of living. So some people in America have said that's not enough, right? There'll be husbands who are so enraged at, not giving their wife a get that they'll eat $55,000 a year. We have enough people who can eat that kind of cost and write it off. And it won't necessarily always be able to produce a get. So maybe we should make it more. And there were those that argued in Eretz Yisrael, this is onerous. No, who lives with $55,000 a year? That's too much. That's a penalty. Rav Sternbach raises that issue. This is too much for Eretz Yisrael. Okay, which might be true, and it needs to be adjusted accordingly. But no one's married, no pun intended, right, to the $150. Whatever is standard living expenses would be fine. However, this is not exactly parallel to the Torah's Gittin. The Torah's Gittin was allowing the original Chiyuv Mezaynus to continue unchecked. Here we're saying, no, there is an artificial Chiyuv Mezaynus that the husband is committing himself to unconditionally. That begins only at such time that she moves out and she'll petition for a get. That's triggered by her petitioning for a get. And it's a new Chiyuv Mezaynus. So what difference does it make if the pressure that's brought to bear is called Mezaynus, or the Chiyuv that's brought to bear is called a penalty? Either way, there's external pressure that's being brought, and to say that it's there not to produce a get is disingenuous. We all know it's there in order to produce a get. That's why it's across the board. It doesn't take into account the fact that she might be quite wealthy and doesn't need the support, right? So the fact that it's across the board is obviously designed in order to produce the get, whether we say so or not. And the fact that it's only triggered once she moves out and petitions for a get, could be viewed as a get moose, even though it's not designed as a penalty, an additional chiyuv mezaynus, which only triggered later, sounds a lot like a penalty, right? So that's why there were those who opposed it. Another reason to question this suggestion is because of a concept that's known as asmachta. A person owes an obligation. He pays part of it. Let's say I owe you $100. $100,000. I pay you $25,000. You want the rest, but I want a receipt. So I take the receipt for the $25,000, I give it to a third party. And I say, you want payment now. So I say, no, give me time. So I say, you know what, I'll install what's called a penalty clause. A penalty clause means, often they install it in contractors' contracts. A guy says he's going to finish my construction, March 1st. I say, you're never going to finish it March 1st. You know you're not going to finish it. I know you're not going to finish it. He says, no, I'm going to finish it March 1st. No contractor is ever on time. Then. He says, Vaharaya, if May 1st comes or April 1st comes and I haven't completed it, I'll take a penalty. It's known as a penalty clause. So to over here, I say, tell the guy, calm down, I'm going to pay you the other $75,000. Variah is, I'm going to give the $25,000 receipt to a third party. If I don't pay you by this and this date, I'm going to tell the third party, tear up the receipt. I'll pay you the $100 again. The whole $100. It's known as a penalty clause. Penalty clauses, I don't think, are necessarily enforceable in secular court. They're frowned upon because it doesn't serve anybody. It's not commensurate with the loss, and So penalty clauses are complicated legally, you know, forcing it in a second court. But besides all that, halachically, it's questionable as well. That's what's known as asmachta. Why? Because I don't believe that this is ever going to happen to me. No one installs a penalty clause thinking that they're going to incur the penalty. That's why they install the penalty clause. So I never accepted upon myself to pay the penalty, and if it eventuality occurs that I become liable to pay the penalty, I never had in mind that this would ever happen. So it's a dispute in the Gemara whether asmachta kanya, asmachta lo kanya. Ostensibly, we paskin asmachta loy kanya. It's not considered to be a kinyan, whether it's the rice or the rabbanon. It has to do with the whole sugi of gambling. When people gamble, they also think they're never going to lose. So if I take their winnings, I'm taking money from them, because everyone who gambles thinks they're going to win, right? Every time you buy a lottery ticket, you're already planning how we're going to distribute the money that we win, and we're already fighting in the car on the way back. I'm not giving you my money, my. So everyone who buys a lottery ticket, no one thinks they're flushing it down the toilet, which they are, because if they would, they wouldn't buy it. So obviously, you got to be in it to win it, right? So every guy who gambles thinks he's going to win. And when he loses, you're really taking money he never meant to give you. So that's always the shaila with gambling, is all based on asmachta. It's people who engage in these kinds of conditional arrangements always think it's going to be resolved in their favor. So to over here, a guy who signs a prenup, when he signs the prenup, he never thought that this would ever happen to him, right? So you never had Gemira's Das. That's Asmachta Lo Kanya. How can we install this? The penalty clause. Are we passing Asmachta Lo Kanya? How can such a thing happen? You're taking his money. So the fact that you're taking his money, Shalok Kedin, might be irrelevant if it's not, it still might not be a Gemusa. It just might or might not be a Gemusa, even though you're taking his money, Shalok Kedin. Either way, it might be Gneva, but it's not a Gemusa. Certainly not an ideal way to go about resolving the situation. However, in order to account for this issue, the Beis Din of America prenup, they installed two conditions, which are based on the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says in Chesh Mishpat, Simen Reish Zayin, Sif Tes Vav, and Sif Yudala, that if you say, May Achshav, I'm obligating myself in this conditional payment, and I say that this is Masul Beis Din Choshev, meaning I'm doing this in the presence of a legitimate Beis Din, basically saying, I understand the consequences of what I am doing, and I understand that this might result in me having to pay. Fine. Then the Shulchan Aruch says, Koha Oimer Kana Woka Beyoiz Tes Vav, Koha Oimer Kana Me Ashav. Ain't kind of smachta klal. As long as I say it's kind of now, it's not an asmachta. The Ramah adds, but you also have to say it's taking place in a Beis Din Choshuv in Me'achshav. Since it's taking place in a Beis Din Choshuv, you don't have to be in the Beis. Obviously, sometimes they sign the prenup in a Beis Din Choshuv. You don't have to be in a Beis Din Choshuv, but I say it's ki'ilu. I understand this is taking place in a Beis Din Choshuv, meaning I'm doing this with Kovid Reish. Then it's not considered to be an asmachta. So that's what it says in the Beis Din of America prenup. This is taking place by Achshav. I obligate myself right now, Beis Din Choshuv, in the presence of a significant Beis Din. The question, though, is if that, what is the role of the Beis Din Choshuv? It might be the role of the Beis Din Choshuv means it's only if I take an item which I already have, like the receipt, and I say, this is an item that exists. If I don't satisfy my obligations, take this and rip it up because it exists. The money is in escrow. He's holding on to it. So then I understand, I say, this money, which is mine, it's not an undefined obligation or even money that doesn't exist now. This is something that exists already. Then I understand, I'm putting it in escrow with the Beis Din Choshuv. Now we all get it. Yeah, I got it. Yeah, I know I mean what I say. If we're discussing an obligation, even though I say, yes, Beis Din Choshuv, Beis Din Chatosi, Avisi Peshayti, Beis Din Choshuv, do I really understand what I'm saying? So Rabbi Gardner, when he brought up this suggestion to Rabbi Yashiv said, most people, chassanim, have no idea what they're signing. Doesn't mean they don't read English. We can all, the document's written in English. Doesn't mean they don't understand. It means they don't understand what it means, May Ashav, Beis Din Choshuv. It's in Asmachta. None of these people think that this is ever going to happen to them. So we are trying to overcome that by explaining what it is, and people should understand it and understand that this is a real obligation that does happen, and it's me'achshav and me'beis din choshuv, and people should understand the consequences of their actions. But me'achshav, argue, most people really don't understand the consequences of what beis din choshuv means, and me'achshav, it's all legalities. And they're not paying attention to any of it. So that was another argument against. And Rav Schoenbach also brings that up. No one ever thinks this is going to happen to them. So it's. So it's somewhat of a different case. What could be a solution, which was already raised by Rav Zalman Nechemi Goldberg in the original article Maria, and could be adjusted, Rav Bleich adjusted it somewhat, his suggestion, but basically the same idea, is that the husband should accept upon himself an additional obligation of mezainis from the very outset of the marriage. which is, a guy could say when he gets married, just like we have in the Ksuba, if you pay attention to what's going on there, there's the Iker Ksuba, right? The Masayim Mana, right? For Psula, Masayim Zuz. But then there we have Tosefes Ksuba, which was added over the generations. So that's why the Ksuba is now about $30,000, something like that, depending on the price of silver. So we can add, that was added over the generations. We could add an additional Chiyuv Mezaynus, that every husband obligates himself to pay his wife support unconditionally from the beginning of the marriage, which could be satisfied in one of two ways. Either living together domestically in the house together, you'll be provided with support. Or if you will move out, I will continue to provide you with support until such time that we both agree to come to Beis Din to resolve the marriage. And which means the wife can't hold him hostage. She can't go off to move to Bermuda and say, well, you promised to provide me support, and, you know, she's not going to take a get. I'll be supported and live, you know, supported for the rest of my life. What could be put in as a stipulation, you'll be provided with support until such time the husband will come to a basement and be ready to provide you with a get. And that could all be installed as an additional key of mizanos, which is not taking place later and triggered by the husband's recalcitrance. It will be already from the very beginning of the marriage. The husband is saying, I'm not going to just obligate myself on the effort for Ozen, Ezon, Yafanasi, Lichi, Kehilchus, Guvern, Yudoin, like they did in the times of the Gemara, I'm going to obligate myself a more unconditional support, which will be Chal now, which you can satisfy either in the house or sometime later, you know, through payments of what will be considered reasonable Mezoinus. But what the benefit of it is, it's not triggered later on, it's right now. And you don't have then any kind of misinterpretation that it could be something they are viewed to produce the get. It's something that has gone going throughout the marriage. Or something. I'm going to come here. Similar matzah. That's Rav Black's suggestion, which I think solves more of the problem. That sits better with, resonates better with me. But Sternbach had two other arguments with the prenup. The first is, he said this is going to encourage people to get divorced because now there's a mechanism that she could obtain a get. I don't know if we're encouraging people to get divorced by this mechanism. People who are otherwise remaining in happy marriages and are now going to dissolve the marriage because of the prenups. Divorce, unfortunately, is quite common. So I don't know if this makes it exacerbates the situation. Maybe there might be differences within the communities of the broader religious community, but you know, different pockets. I can't speak to that. But others have argued, it's not minanimus. Here you have a couple so happy. What are we bringing up these kinds of heavy issues with them? You know, let them enjoy this time. So the truth of the matter is, it's really no different than the ksuba, right? I mean, the ksuba, when I explain, I'm a Masada Kedushin, I usually explain to the chassan, at the chassan's tish, what he's obligating himself. If the marriage will divorce, you know, dissolve, you'll be obligating yourself to pay $30,000. And, you know, most people are like, what? Yeah, but you have to understand what the ksuba is, that the husband obligating himself to at the chassan's tish. When he picks up the pen, in lieu of that, he's obligating himself to pay the wife the ksuba, if the marriage will dissolve. So we're discussing these issues anyway, and people hang that in their dining room for everyone to see, you know, if the marriage will dissolve, I agree to pay you this, and these are my obligations, and these are your obligations. I mean, this doesn't seem like something you'd hang on the wall, but yet we discuss this at a time of wedding. So over here to discuss this also, I don't know if this really, you know, adds to that, you know, situation. If anything, other rabbi, I think it might be something that's highly appropriate. Why? Because Eliezer, when he goes to search for a shidduch, for Rivka, what's the first thing, the only thing he looks for? A sign from the Ribbono Shel Olam is that of chesed, that she does chesed to others. And in fact, that's why he sent her to the people of Avram Avinu, was Mashbih Eliezer. She go to the people of Charan. The Ran explains in his drushes, why are they any better than the people of Canaan? Charan was not great people either. So he explains, because they had better midas. Midas tivis are critical in order for the marriage to be successful. But not only midas tivis, chesed, bedavka chesed. In fact, the one nation we're never allowed to marry into, into the nation of Amon and Moav, which we read about later on in Parshas Kisezi, Parshas Shoftim, is Aldvar, Shelo Kidmo, Eschem, Belechem, Uvamayim, Bederech, Betzesim, and Mitzrayim. They didn't provide us with bread and water on our way out of Mitzrayim, Amon and Moav. So therefore, we can't marry into them forever. L'doyre doyreis, because they didn't give us milk and cookies. Why? Why is that a reason? Oh, by the way, Bilam also they hired to kill us, right? Moav hired Bilam. That's not mentioned. It's chesed first. Why? Because a marriage is built on chesed. If there's no chesed, he can't have a marriage. So they can't marry in because they're not Baalei Chesed. By the way, a fantastic word. You have to know this from last week's parsha. It says the Chedush Harim that's why the Malachim asked Avram Avinu, Ayei Sara Ishtecha. Where is Sarah, your wife? What are they asking after? Where is Ayei Sarah Ishtecha? And where does Avram Avinu respond? She's Hinei Ba'oyo. Says Rashi, Kokfudo Bas Melech Penima. She doesn't come out. Why they mention this? So it says the Chidushei Harim. It was in order to teach us this halacha, since the wife doesn't come out to serve the guests anyway, even though we can't marry Amon and Moav, that's only the men. They didn't come out to give us milk and cookies. But the women, they had to remain inside anyway. So there's no taina against them that they didn't provide us with milk and cookies. This is the basis for the drasha. We can't marry Amon and Moav, but we can't marry the females. Why is derived from Sarah? Sarah stayed inside. So we can marry you can marry that woman of Amon and Moav, which is the reason why Lot was saved. Lot was saved only, says the Medrash, because his daughters ultimately would be Amon and Moav, which would produce Rus, would go on to be the mother of David HaMelech. So they asked her in order so that Lot's daughters could be saved and ultimately produce David HaMelech, which would produce Rus, which would produce David HaMelech. Rus only married Boaz because Amoni v'Amonis Moav v'Moavis. That's why you have to know this. Shimshon Ashtapoya. In Megillas Rus, every pasuk begins with a vav except eight psukim. Every pasuk begins with a vav. The eight psukim are Rashi Tevis. Yishi, my salvation, ba'oihel, was in the tent. Rus only existed, says Rishim Shemiel Shapoya, because Sarah remained in the tent. Since Kol Kvudo Bas Melech Penimah, Sarah remained in the tent, there's no taina on the people, on the women of Amon and Moav, because they weren't obligated to provide milk and cookies anyway. So that's ultimately what enabled Rus to marry Boaz. And that was ultimately what produced David HaMelech. So Yishi Boyeho. But why is Chesed so important? The answer is because a marriage is built on Chesed. Marriage is built on Chesed. Therefore, we can't marry people who are not Ba'alei Chesed. So too, I always feel. At the beginning of a marriage, it's very important for a couple to understand Chesed with each other, yes. But also, now that you're a couple, you have to perform Chesed for others. And what better Chesed could there be than helping a person in the worst possible situation of being an aguno? So if a couple takes a little bit of time, yes, it stares a little bit, no doubt, to sit with a notary before a wedding, you know, it's not. But if you couch it in the terms of it's not for us, it's for helping other people, it's never Chas v'Shalom be by us. But it comes to other people, so I think it's a very, very appropriate thing. Perhaps could couch the whole marriage in terms of a marriage of chesed. All right. Good.